Now, Perry, you've told me there are a lot of questions these guys are going to ask. What are some of the most common that you've come across?
Well, yeah, they are going to ask you a lot of questions, and I'll tell you that a lot of times they're going to ask you questions. Beware of this. A lot of times these guys are going to ask you questions that they really know you almost can't answer.
That's interesting. So why would they do that?
Well, because really, they want to see if you're going to just make something up. It's a trust issue, for one thing. So if you don't have an answer to something, don't just fly off the seat of your pants and just come up with an answer.
Just pull things out of the air.
Pull things out of the air. A great example of this, that whether you're how your politics lean doesn't really matter, but Bill Clinton, if you'll ever notice Bill Clinton in a debate, when he was in debates before, would put his fingers in front of him in a pyramid shape, and he would pause for about 10 seconds before he answered every question. It's a really good posturing, by the way. The body language means that you're concentrating, you're thinking, you're putting together a good answer. And you're listening. Shows you're listening and you're really taking in the information they gave you. And secondly, the fact that you paused for about 10 seconds before you answered showed that you're forming a sentence, you're forming a reasonable answer, and two, that you think before you talk.
So it's showing you're a thoughtful
yeah, it shows that
person.
You're thoughtful, and basically, if you can't answer the question, say just be honest and say, right now I don't have the information to be able to answer that question for you accurately. I can go back and work on that and get an answer back to you as soon as possible. I can give you an estimate. I can give you a guess if you want to know what I think I could do or what I think that will happen. But whether or not that would be, truthfully what will happen, I'm not sure. An answer like that is way better than just pulling a number out of the air or making up a story that's not believable. Because these guys, I mean, let me tell you, this is not their first rodeo.
Right.
This is what they do for a living. They've heard it all, man. They've been down the pike with people, everything from just total flim-flam artists to geniuses, to wackos, to everything else.
So don't think you're going to come in there with something that they've never seen or heard before.
Yeah, you're not going to snow them. So, but anyway, some of the questions, back to some of the questions that they're going to ask you, I'll give you a few of the ones that you can almost, these are textbook. I mean, you can practically expect the majority of these in a presentation. Now, if you get out of the presentation and go, wow, they didn't ask me any of the questions that Perry said they were going to ask me. They didn't ask me anything. Well, you probably got a pretty big problem. If they didn't ask you any questions, their level of interest is relatively low, if non-existent, basically. So, if you get the end and say, does anybody have any questions? And they say, no, we really don't. I would ask right then, did I do something wrong?
It could be the kiss of death.
Yeah, it is the kiss of death, really. If they don't have questions, you obviously did something wrong. You obviously missed the market. You did something that they just got turned off by. So anyway, one of the first things they're going to ask you is, most of these questions are like, when you hear them, you're going to go, wow, that's basic. But they are basic. Is, why do you think people are going to buy your product?
Okay.
Why do you think they're going to buy it? And also, more importantly, why do you think they're going to buy it from you? What competitive advantage do you have?
Okay.
That's going to make the customer want to deal with you specifically, your company, your product, versus other products in your marketplace. Why are people going to want to buy the product to start with in the entire market? And then why are they going to want to buy why are they going to buy it from you?
Is that, now, I mean, without diving into the details, now, when, as far as why they would buy it from you, is that more of a function of, like, the product itself, the marketing?
That's
so
your
like
unique
the,
selling proposition. That's
okay.
What's different about what you're doing. What makes you stand out? What makes you remarkable?
Gotcha.
Second, they're going to say something like, I like what you're doing, but I really don't believe your market's as big as you say it is. How did you arrive at your market statistics?
So be ready to be challenged.
Yeah. They're not going to just take what you say at face value. And a lot of times it's like the math teacher, 16 times 34 is X. Well, show me your math. Show me your work. That's the reason your math teacher always wanted to see how you worked out your problem, so they know that you just didn't look over the shoulder of the kid sitting next to you.
Right.
His answer.
Right.
Not that I ever did that. But, excuse me. They're going to ask you too, what makes you think you're going to be able to capture, you think the market is this big, you think you're going to get this percentage of market share, how come? Why? Why do you think you're going to get that particular percentage of market share? So you, these things are like, you know, people will sit down all the time and go, you know, this is a billion-dollar market. If we just got a 10% market share, we'd do $100 million. Well, how are you going to go about getting a 10% market share? What 10% of the customers, are you going to grow 10%? Are you going to grow the market?
Yeah.
So that's, there's basically two ways to do that. You're either going to grow the market itself and take the growth, or you're going to come in and erode the market away from another competitor. Smart money knows that eroding the money away from another competitor is much more difficult to do. If you can grow the market, like for instance, eBay grew the auction market. You know, they were online auction, but they were still an auction company fundamentally. They grew the online, they grew the auction market, which was an already existing market. Mm-hmm. They totally grew a new leg, as turned out to be a giant leg on the auction market. And because they were the first adopter, because they were the first market movers in that area, they were able to capture a huge percentage of the growth of the industry. See what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So companies, most people that are funny usually choose that versus, well, I'm going to go out and steal business away from this guy.
Now, when they ask a question like that, and obviously they're looking to see what your answer is, but what else could they be looking at as far as like your response goes? I know you mentioned
how
like,
well you know posture. Your business. I mean, Okay. Really, how well do you know your market? And man, it's revealing. If you watch these shows, there's a really great show that comes on in Canada called the Dragon's Den. Man, it is the most awesome show, and they don't do it here in the U.S. I wish they did. But what it is, it's basically a show that comes on every week, and seven or eight people go in and pitch their idea to a group of angel investors. And these are all kind of famous Canadian entrepreneurs. And these guys come in and pitch their idea. And you wouldn't believe these guys, they're prepared to go on television. They know they're going to be on television in front of a national audience, in front of 10 super sophisticated people. And they'll come in and they'll ask them just a basic question about their industry. And they just don't know.
They just don't know.
They don't know. You know, people get all consumed about, oh, I'm going to start this. I'm going to start, you know, start this business. And I'm going to sell this widget. And they end up not even knowing, you know, the basics of their market. They don't know the age demographic.
So they just fall so much in love with their idea.
Yeah. They don't know the age demographic. They don't know the sex of the buyer. They don't know the economic level of the buyer. And in most, again, another little tip I'll throw in here. Most of the venture capital people that I've dealt with in the past, and most of the angel investor people that I've dealt with in the past, they want to see that you're market centric. The if you build it, they will come idea doesn't really work, and everybody knows that. You've got to have a market first.
Right.
They will fund it. A lot of times, if you'll look and see the hottest things being funded in venture capital, you know, during the .com boom, a chimpanzee could have walked in with a domain name and got money.
Right.
Because there was this giant tidal wave rolling. And they knew that a substandard player could jump into this arena and do well. Where, you know, once that market's mature, if you say, well, you know, I got a great business idea, I'm going to go in and I think I'm going to start a search engine website. And if I can just take 10% of Google's market, you know, I'll make $1 billion. Well, the thing is, Google ain't going to give up 10% voluntarily.
Right.
That's number one. They're not going to say, yeah, you know what, that guy's working pretty hard. I think I'll give him 10% market share. They're not going to do that. And the smart investor knows, bigger than that, that if there's 10% out there to gain, if there's a 10% market share to gain, you being a brand new, inexperienced newbie, and Google being a monster powerhouse with a room full of 1,000 PhDs, who's the most likely, if you're an odds player, to gain that additional 10%?
Yeah, not you.
Yeah, not you. So you've got to kind of create a brand new space. You know, it's the best thing that you can do. It's kind of create a brand new space. You know, look at Mrs. Fields Cookies is a great idea. You know, you had, this is several years, many years ago, but I mean, she was the first gourmet cookie chain. You had, Keebler had a lot. You know, Keebler and Nabisco had a lock on the cookie business. They had Oreos and they had Chips Ahoy and whatever, and that was the cookie business.
Right.
They weren't giving up any more market share. Mrs. Fields said, people will buy $3 cookie. And everybody thought she was nuts until she went out to the mall and proved her point. And the point is, for a long time, not now, but I mean, still has a nice market share, but for a long time, she was the only fish in her pond. So she maybe expanded the cookie into the cookie market 10% and took a probably 50, 60% of that share that she grew.
Right, just because it was carving out that new piece, just creating that new piece.
She was the trailblazer, you know, and then and pretty soon along comes competition. And being the first, a smart guy told me one time, one of the greatest places to be in positioning your business is to be the first second on a hot product. You know, great examples of that are in the online world. Where is Alta Vista today? They were the hottest search engine going for a while. They were on fire. They're nowhere now. There are a lot of companies that came out and trailblazed an industry and then just went away.
Because there was other people that were
positioned. The smart observer says, the smart observer sits back and sees everything they're doing right and goes, well, that's a great idea. Where are they having problems? Oh, well, they did this wrong, they did this wrong, they did this wrong, they did this wrong. Okay, we'll just go do that. Well, we'll omit those problems. And the first second has a real advantage, especially if they've got strong management. And usually these trailblazing companies that come out, they kind of got lucky most of the time. Not always, but most of the time they just got lucky. They kind of stumbled across, I'm from the South, and the old joke is even every now and then the old blind sow finds an acorn. And a lot of these people just stumbled across something that was fantastic.
They may not even actually know what they have yet.
No, they didn't know what they had. When the eBay guy started selling Pez containers, he had no idea he was going to build a multi-billion-dollar industry.
Right.
Which he was pretty smart, by the way, and immediately turned the company over to the management team and backed out and took a chairman seat. Because he knew he couldn't run a multinational corporation, which is a whole different conversation to have.
He recognized his skill sets, though, and brought the right people in.
Yeah. What's the most compelling aspect? They're going to ask you, what do you think you do the very best as a company, as a manager, as an entrepreneur? What do you think your product does the very best? They may ask you, if you got the greatest idea in the world, who else is doing this? And believe it or not, if your answer is, well, nobody else is doing what I'm doing, you better have a pretty quick explanation as to why. Because that sends off a red flag. You know, it's sort of like going back to what we talked about before. Oh, I don't have any competitors. Well, everybody has competitors. Or there's no market. The market creates a vacuum. It just does. And entrepreneurs fill that vacuum. We're really good at it.
Right.
And there are millions now that with the global market closing in, there's millions and millions and millions upon millions of entrepreneurs. There's very little out there that, in way of market, that somebody isn't trying to plug.
Right.
You know, so when you say that nobody really is competitive against you and you just have the total advantage, nobody's done this before. Be careful with what you say. Another really basic question is, why should I invest in your business? And what they're going to look for there is to see your level of naivety. Are you going to say, well, if you invest in my business, you could make a lot of money back. I could probably pay you back 10-15% a year on your investment. It'd be what better than a bank and. That's the big signal to get out the front door. Because they're looking, like we said before, for 5 to 10 times their investment in about 18 to 24-month period. So if they, these guys are not bank lenders. They're not looking for interest rates. They're looking for equity that returns high ROI. They may ask you why you came to them. Why do you think we'd be a good partner for you?
That's interesting. Why would, what are they looking for there?
Just really to see if you did your homework. If all you're looking for is money, you want to show them early on that you're looking for a partner that has more to offer than just cash. And you are, by the way. If you're not, you shouldn't even start down this road. Because you know, what you really want and what you get with venture capital firms that people always talk bad about venture capital firms and angel investors. So they've heard the term vulture capitalist before. And really, venture capital companies, you get an advantage you don't get almost anywhere else. You go give up a lot of equity and whatever, but you also now have a skilled partner, an experienced entrepreneur.
With just endless resources.
Endless resources, endless connections, you know, with an absolute vested interest in your success.
So they're going to use all those resources. Yeah, they don't want to see you fail.
Yeah, they're going to use every resource they possibly can to help you.
Yeah.
You know, versus knowing somebody that has a lot of resources but has no real vested interest in you. So, they're going to ask you, and, you know, hopefully you can tell them, I researched you, I've seen other projects you've done, I've seen how you help these other companies, I think we're in a similar marketplace, you seem to have the right connections, this seems to be your expertise, I've researched your board members and their prior experience,
mm-hmm.
and I think they bring a lot to the table for us, yada, yada, yada. They don't want to come run your company, so don't give them the impression you want them to come run the business, because that's not what they want at all.
So they're really, just from the beginning, they're looking for somebody that they can tell has really thought through this process and is a person that really thinks things through.
Absolutely. Absolutely. They're going to ask you, what's going to keep your, you got a great whiz bang. What's going to keep the competitor, what's going to keep your competition from knocking you off?
Okay.
You know, so you need to have, this is becoming a bigger and bigger area. Barrier to entry, basically. You need to show that the competitor is going to have a significant barrier to entry. That you have the proper team. This is where team comes in big time. You have the proper team to always be the best, not just today.
Right.
You know, you may be coming out getting startup capital, and there are three other startups doing what you're doing. You know, and if you had three YouTubes coming to the table, let's say, all of them are doing video hosting, all of them doing the same thing. Then the big decision is going to be made. Who's going to have the most progressive team that's probably going to keep this thing in constant updates, constantly getting better, constantly being managed well? Then a lot rides on the team at that point.
So how innovative, how much energy,
yeah, and if you can start showing. And what they really want to see here is stuff like strategic alliances. Maybe, we know a client that has, they do a streaming. They do streaming online training. And their big barrier to entry is they have a contract with the American Bar Association or with a bunch of the state bar associations. So they have a long-term contract with these associations and a long-term. So they don't have particularly proprietary technology, but it would be very difficult for someone to go around all their locked-in relationships.
It's a very solid relationship.
Yeah, so it may be technology that's proprietary. It may be patents that you have. It might be strategic alliances, relationships that you have. You know, what they really want to see here is that you have an unfair advantage on a playing field. You know, they really want to see that because they don't know you. And they know... If you think about it, it makes all the sense in the world. They know that you're a fledgling startup guy. The odds of you going out and slaying the dragon, who's been out there doing the same thing you're doing for a long period of time and knows the marketplace, knows the customers, already has a base, already has cash flow, already has all those things, is difficult. Really difficult.
Right.
They know that. So they really want to see that you have, some big advantage. And it can be business model too, but business models are easily duplicated, for the most part. If you've got, we got this cool way of selling grapefruits that nobody's thought about selling grapefruits. We're going to put them in, we're going to put them in individual plastic packages, and so people can take their grapefruits to work with them. And they won't. Well, how long is it going to be? How long is it going to be before all the grapefruit makers do the same thing?
Yeah.
If you a big strategic advantage, by the way, Dutch Boy Paint Company. I don't know if you've seen them.
Mm-mm.
Dutch Boy was just about out of business. I mean, they were an inch from out of business. And they came up with the paint can that has a handle on it and the pour spout. You know, where everybody else had the big metal paint can.
Right.
They got the plastic paint can that has a spout on it. So you pour it out like a pitcher of milk or a pitcher of Kool-Aid.
Solving the paint dripping all over the sides problem.
Absolutely a deal changer. The company went through the roof. and is back on the top of the paint business again.
Wow.
Because they changed that one functional problem. And they had a patent on that container. They had a design patent on the container. They had all the tooling already done.
So there would be a barrier right there.
They already had retail distribution. So nobody can do that for 17 years. So if you believed in that concept, was going to sell more paint than anybody else because of this cool concept, they got a 17-year lock. Would you want to invest in that company?
Absolutely.
Of course. So, and a lot of companies did. You know, they're going to want to hear your marketing strategy, you know, how really doable your thing is. You know, what's your market strategy? What's your marketing strategy? And you need to have a nice little one-minute pitch that explains exactly how you're going to get the message of what you have out. You know, where you're going, how you're going to refine your market, how you're going to get the message to the market. And, you know, that's all, you know, again, back to, we talked about triad marketing not too long ago, but media, market, message. That's the deal. What's the message you're going to deliver? Who's your market? And what media are you going to reach them by?
And that needs to, you need to be able to show that to them very succinctly.
Absolutely. We're going to do, you know, we're going to do these oversized postcards. We're going to direct mail them. And we're going to do it to, paint contracting companies to show them our new paint can.
Probably be a good idea to have something that you've already even tested.
Yeah, sure. Oh yeah, if you've got that's by far the best. Here's our marketing piece. Our preliminary test show with a mailing of 1,000 or 10,000 pieces. We had a 6.4% response rate. Here's a list of the respondents. Here's how we followed up in a follow up sequence. Here's who bought. Here's who didn't. And here's why. We went back and surveyed them. And find out this is why they didn't buy or this is why they did buy. That's a kind of data that they're going to look at and go, how many did you mail? You mailed 1,000, right? Okay, you mailed 1,000 of these. It cost you $500 to mail them, let's say. And you sold $5,000 worth of paint at a 50% profit. So you made $2,500 on $500, right?
Right.
How many more places are there like this that you can mail?
Hopefully a lot.
Yeah. If you've got a mailing list of 2-3 million that you can acquire somehow, that's a similar mailing list and convince them it's similar, then you're a locked deal.
That's a no-brainer for them.
You got pretty much a locked deal. Yeah. If you've proven a model on a small scale that's not easily duplicatable but is very scalable, then you almost have a locked deal.
So doing like a small market test like that would really be huge to have that kind of ammunition in front of those guys.
One good question is, you know, what do you, I assume that, you know, they're going to ask you just like this because I've had this question asked. So I assume you want to be the CEO of the company, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, Nathan, what have you done in the past that would qualify you as the CEO of a large corporation? You think this company is going to get to $50 million. You graduated from college 2 months ago, and you've been working at the Whataburger.
Right.
So what do you think qualifies you to be the CEO of a $50 million company?
I mean, honest answer would be like, I don't think there's a whole lot that does qualify me.
Yeah.
I mean,
and you got a lot of oohs and ahs in there. Yeah. So, you know, and really, I think what they want to see there is they don't want you just to buckle down. They want to see some entrepreneurial spirit. So you know what? I this is my idea. I've tested it. I've proven that I can make it work on a small scale, and I believe that I can do it on a large scale. I think let them know that you realize though that you're going to need qualified help.
Would it be a bad idea to then bring up, you know, and that's one of the reasons why I'm here with you, because your experience.
A lot of them want to know. A lot of these guys are going to want to know that if the company gets to a point where it's way out of your range, that you're not going to be a bear to fight to let them bring in a real CEO and run the company. I mean, and honestly, as much as you're out there going, they want to take my company, you should know, most people I know that have made a lot of money working with VCs have went in, formed a company, ran it for a while, let it get to a point where it's kind of out of their hands, let the VC company help them, go in together, they agree on a CEO, they bring in a very experienced management person. They take a back seat.
Kind of like a chairman position or something like that.
Yeah, just like the gentleman did with eBay. Take a back seat and you go relax. Now all that pressure that you had's on that CEO's back to perform. And they're probably going to do a better job than you. You just got to know it. You know, I like to sing. yeah, I love to sing country music, but I know that George Strait's a better singer than me.
Right.
So, you know, I'm never going to be that good. So if I had a certified, absolute, couldn't miss country hit song, I'd much rather give my song to George Strait and let him go make me a couple $1 million and go try to sing it myself, because nobody's going to listen.
Right.
You know, so that's kind of, you know, where that's at.
Are there any more you got for us?
Oh, there are a lot. Those are some of the biggest ones. You know, they're going to ask you some things about some kind of negative things. You know, what weaknesses do you see in your management team?
So another good chance to really be honest and transparent.
Yeah, no, I don't see any. Really. You know, they're perfect. You know, and that's the what you want to do is defend. You know, your natural instinct is going to be, oh, we don't have any weaknesses. We're great. We're terrific, man. We can cover everything. No matter what happens, we got it going on. They just know that not to be true. One big question is always, if you're coming in with a brand new idea, they're going to say, is it going to sell? Oh, yeah, we think we're going to sell. You know, every time we touch 100 customers, we're going to sell 10, and you know, we're going to make $1 billion. Well, how many have you sold so far? Well, we hadn't had the money to go out and do the big marketing test yet to try. Well, I thought if you sent 100 pieces of mail or you touched 100 advertisers, you shook 100 people's hand, you'd sell 10. Well, yeah, we would. Well, why haven't you went out and met 100 people yet? You know, really, you know, they'll find the
spots and poke holes in it.
Then what it looks like is you're just there to get money to coast on, basically. You know, think about it. If somebody came to you and said, "Hey, Nathan, if we send out, you know, if I go knock on 50 doors this afternoon, I know we can sell 10 people something for $1,000. So here's what I want to do. I want you to loan me $10,000 so I can go get 20 people to go knock on doors. Well, would you do that? Or would you say, well, heck, let's go get in the car and go knock on some doors and see if what you're saying works or not?
Right, let's see the proof.
Then it's pretty easy to come back to you. You know, hey, I went knocked on 50 doors this afternoon. Here's $10,000. Now I'd like to borrow $100,000 to go knock on, to have 10 more people go knock on doors with me.
Right.
See how much different the equation is?
Absolutely.
It's so much easier. You know, one of the things they're going to ask, getting down toward the end now, is two questions that are really just ugly questions is, well, the one's not, but is who do you think would be a potential buyer for your company?
So again, back to understanding your market.
Yeah. Who do you think, not a buyer for your product, who do you think, you know, once you've matured this thing 3 or 4 years, you realize that we as an angel investor or venture capital fund, our money's made an exit strategy, right?
Gotcha, yeah.
Who do you think might be in the market to buy a company like yours if you're successful, successful?
Yeah, so that would be, knowing that would show them that you're already thinking about exit plan.
You're thinking exit strategy on the front end. They're going to ask a question like that. And then, you know, one of the hardest questions to answer is what happens if it doesn't work?
What are they looking for there?
You know, that you have a disaster plan. What if you find out when you go to broad testing that your small testing worked, your big testing doesn't? You got $1 million from us in equity. You burnt through $700,000 of it. You can't figure it out.
So what's plan B?
What are we going to do? What are we going to do if it doesn't work out, if everything's not peaches and cream?
So you're definitely going to blow some hair back if you have a well-thought-out plan B.
Yeah.
They might be a little bit surprised.
Well, yeah, and this is basically damage control. You know, because a great answer would be, well, number one, we're not going to go out and spend $700,000 and $1 million. We're going to continue testing. You know, I know you guys want return right away, but to be honest with you, I don't want to risk a lot of your money that you give me for probably the first 90 to 120 days because I want to test more before we take significant financial risks. So that if we run into a major problem, we've taken the minimal amount of risk, the minimal amount of loss possible, and even if we only do this much business, you will easily recoup the small percentage we've spent, and there'll be no net negative loss, or minimum net negative loss.
And then they know that you're not just looking to go out there and just blow their money and just hope that it works.
Yeah, risk avoidance, basically. They want to know that you have a risk avoidance plan, that you're not just going to go, because that, you know, what a lot of people who get venture capital money go, okay, I got this money, it's somebody else's, I'm ready to go roll the dice. Let's just go put it all on red. You know, if we win, we got twice as much. If we lose, you know, wouldn't ours to start with.
Right.
And that's what they want to make sure that you're not going to do something stupid like that. But that's kind of the, you know, basically that's the majority of the questions that I would say are going to be asked, the ones that you really need to be prepared for. But okay. Just know that they're going to ask you very pointed questions. And they're going to be mainly about the holes in your presentation.
Okay.
You know, they're gonna find those holes in your presentation. One thing you want to really do, and most people will never mind it, say, you know, do you mind when I give the presentation if I turn on my voice recorder? Because I want to remember the questions that you ask so I can answer them, make sure that I get back with everybody and have the proper... Because they know you can't take notes or write while you're doing the presentation. You need to... This is just like the post-game show. You know, football games. They go back and watch the tapes of the game. That's how they learn how to play better games next week.
And also, I guess, like you said, like they'll actually remember to follow up on like specific questions. And again, that's probably something that goes a long way.
And chances are, you're not going to pitch once and get all the money you want. You know, chances are. Hope you do.
That'd be great.
You know, hope you do. But chances are, you know, you're not going to pitch. You're not going to pitch right away. And I always recommend that people pitch to their... probably some of the lower people on their list. If they get a lot of offers to come pitch, I would pitch to some of my smaller funds, less likely funds first, just because it's going to give you some experience before you go talk to the fund that you really, really, really want. And I would say one last piece of advice there, and I think I probably cover it somewhere else as we go through, but pitch simultaneously. You don't want to... It's kind of weird. In VC or angel investing, everybody wants a piece of the hot deal.
Right.
Okay? What you don't want to do is pitch once a month for 12 months. Because what happens then is your deal has been shopped by 11 people and everybody passed. You know what I mean?
Right.
A better position to be in is that you're pitching... You just gang up all your appointments and you pitch 10, 12 times in a week. And that way all of your, you got deal sheets out all over the place. You got proposals out all over the place. It's super hectic time, but you let everybody know, hey, I'll get back with you tomorrow. I'm going to be pitching over here today. I got to go over here today and see these people, this capital company. And that way you create a level of, this gets back to marketing. You create a level of scarcity.
Wasn't in some excitement there, like there's a lot happening.
There's a lot happening. You got a lot going on. A lot of people are willing to see you. And, you know, you are one deal.
I guess it also shows your level of seriousness, too. Yeah. Like you're really
shows in your
it.
Level of seriousness. But what you might do is, and absolutely rehearse your pitch before you go the first time. You know, we talked about before having your group of 20 people or 10 people or however many people you get to give you $100 and maybe some more money later. Those are the first people you need to pitch to. And you need to have them, here's what I'm going to ask you to do. Get yourself in a mind frame, okay? I'm about to ask you for half of your life savings to invest in this business. Imagine that. I'm going to pitch my presentation to you. Now, I want to know what questions do you have to ask?
Let's really make sure and set them up right so you get the kind of feedback that's going to help you out the most.
Serious, serious, serious stuff, you know. And you're going to get to see me and one more deal, and you have to invest in one or the two.
Okay.
Or you just lose your money. You know, so you're really going to seriously consider me. What questions would you ask me, and what questions would you ask the other guy coming to pitch you before you made a decision where you're going to place your money? Because they're going to come up with a whole list of questions you're probably not going to think about, and that mastermind mentality will get you a long way. Because you're only going to you know individuals only think in a one dimension. You know, basically you're going to have to think dimensionally. You don't have any choice. So
that makes sense.
So try to get your group involved.
Now, would it be is now a good time to start talking about valuation?
Absolutely.
Now, Perry, we're going to talk about valuation. I realize this is something that hangs a lot of people up. What, you know, first, what is valuation, and you know, what exactly does that mean?
Well, valuation means what's your company worth.
Okay.
You know, that when a angel investor or a venture capital company comes in to invest in you, they're going to invest in you based on what you're worth. You know, what would you be willing to sell part of your company for? That's basically what they're going to ask you.
Okay.
And if your company is an idea and not much more, then it's going to have a minimal value. If it's a proven idea, it's going to have more value. If it's a proven and tested idea, it's going to have yet more value.
All right.
If you've actually entered the market, that's different. You know, so stages of investment are different. But basically, what they're going to do is, this is kind of hard to explain on audio, but basically what a company's going to do is take you're going to do some earnings estimates. You're going to estimate what you think your gross sales are going to be. You're going to estimate what you think your net profits are going to be. And they're going to look out 2 or 3 years out and say, okay, if in 2 years you're making, or 3 years you're making, let's say $2 million a year.
Okay.
Then they're going to look at what they figure they could sell that company for in 2 years.
So that's one of the factors that they're going to be looking at?
Yeah. So let's say, for instance, that you have a business plan and it shows you're going to be making $2 million in 2 years.
Okay.
A year, right? So if they feel like they're going to sell out to a mergers and acquisitions company, then they're probably going to sell it somewhere around 5x earnings. So that means your company valuation might be $10 million.
Okay.
If they think that the IPO market is really hot for what you're doing, they may sell for 20x earnings. So they may feel like your company is worth $40 million, you know. But what people don't take into consideration, then they've got to take how much share do they have of the business. So let's say, for instance, if they're investing $1 million and they think in 2 years you're going to sell for $10 million, if they get 30% share for $1 million, or let's say they get half for $1 million, then they're going to basically get back $5 million in 2 years. That's within their parameter of what they want to see. But what gets taken into consideration is discounting. Your estimates are going to get discounted based on a number of factors. We talked about that earlier, I think.
Right.
And they're not going to just take your numbers at face value and say, oh, well, obviously, if he says he's going to make $2 million a year, there's just no question at all he's going to do that.
Right.
So they're going to go back and look at historical trends, things they've seen in the past, and what causes companies to miss milestones.
And that's where they start discounting.
Yeah, they're going to start discounting. And then they have another leverage we'll talk about in a second. There's going to be a different strategy that they use also to dilute your shares down. It's called dilution. And that's in case you don't meet your milestones, and it helps to ensure that they get their ROI. It doesn't help to ensure that you get yours.
Okay.
So we'll talk about that in a second too. But first I want to talk about the valuation factors. These are the things that determine what your company is worth in the eyes of the investor. Number one, size of the market.
Okay.
That is always your number one valuation consideration.
That's a big one.
Yeah. What is the size of the potential market you can penetrate? Now, like we talked about before, doesn't mean it's the size of the cookie market. It's the size of the gourmet cookie market.
Are they looking at the size of like the bodies, or like just like the revenue?
The dollars.
So it's always about the dollar.
Strictly the dollars and okay. The profit. You know, and probably what a Mrs. Fields did is came in and opened a cookie store in a mall and said, okay, we're surprised in this marketplace. You know, there's $1 million worth of cookies sold a week. But in the mall, we got one little store and we're selling $10,000 worth of cookies a week. So we got a 1% market share in one little store. You know, so we think that nationwide, if we open a bunch of stores, we could have 1% of all the cookie market. The cookie market's a $10 billion market, let's say. So that's how they justify their market. They didn't have that market yet. That market didn't exist yet. But they'd proven they could carve it out in a very small geographical area.
Okay.
So if they could repeat that, you know, that's the thing. They're going to look at the experience of the team, the skills of the team, how they've performed in the past, what they've done well, what they've done poorly. And really, a lot of it's going to, they're going to look at their accomplishments, the team's accomplishments. So when you're putting a team together, the fact that they have skills is important. The fact that they've accomplished something in the past is probably more important.
So you personally want to be have, I guess, know what their track record is and be able to display that.
They're going to look at how real, how doable your business concept is. How realistic is what you're trying to do. Okay. If it's logical, that helps, you know. If it's semi-proven or proven, that helps a whole lot more. You know, just the fact that it makes sense on paper.
Right.
I can sit down with a piece of paper and make you believe practically anything makes money. You can make anything work on paper with enough imagination.
Yeah, well, I mean, look at some of the sports teams out there. They look great on paper, and then they get destroyed by the right team.
Right, or the right coach.
Yeah,
you know,
good point.
Big time.
Good point.
So it's very much like sports management, really. You know, how many – they're going to look at who might be willing to buy you, you know, and how big is the market for somebody who would want to buy you. You know, are you in an industry that's unsavory? You know, to where public companies wouldn't be interested in acquiring you.
I see.
Are you in an industry that's on a decline, where the companies that are out there that are big players in the market are not really actively acquiring right now? You know, that's a big deal. They're going to look at how strong the IPO market is. Could you potentially be an IPO candidate? See, that's where, for a VC firm, that's a home run hit. If they don't figure they're going to get that out of most of their deals that they do. But if they occasionally can get an IPO out of a deal that they funded, it makes up for a whole lot of, you know, my buddy Ryan calls that a slack adjuster. You know, it makes up for a lot of screw-ups.
Gotcha.
You know, if you get, because they potentially can invest $1 million in you. If you go IPO and they do everything right, they maybe can make $100 million back. So they can afford to screw up 99 more deals and
right.
still be okay. So if one out of 100 goes IPO, so they're going to look at your IPO likelihood. And if your IPO likelihood is high, you know.
It's definitely going to help.
Definitely helps. you know, how much money do they think you're going to need in additional funding, you know, after they fund you? Because what happens is, typically speaking, as additional funding comes into the deal, the founder and the primary funder, shares get diluted based on how much more money you bring in. So it's like basically you and I own, you own half, I'm going to invest in you, right, Nathan?
Mm-hmm.
So you own the company right now. So I'm going to buy half your company for $1 million. So now you own half and I own half.
Yeah.
So as I'm an angel investor, you're the founder. So now you own half, I own half, right? We get a year down the road, everything's going super great. But we realize we're really going to have $5 million more dollars to make this thing work.
Is that something that they would discount in the beginning for? You know what I'm asking?
They might, yeah. Yeah, they might. Depending on how you're structured. And sometimes they're going to have some things, non-delusion clauses. And we'll talk about that when we get to the deal sheets
okay.
and the term sheets. But it's something to be very careful for, because they may have in their contract that your shares get diluted and theirs don't. So there's, and that's very common, by the way.
So that's
so you may end up with, it may be that, well, we need to raise $5 million more. We got to sell some shares. And they look at you and say, that's fine. Go sell some of yours. We're keeping ours. And that would be on the founder.
Right.
So maybe the founder ends up with 25%. The new round of financing ends up with 25%. And they end up with half. You know, and that's very possible. But they're going to look at that, because usually there's some dilution required on their part.
Got
in those
it.
Situations. So, but also, as they get more money, cash comes in, usually the valuation of the stock really goes up.
Okay.
So they don't mind that so much. You know, they want to know the quality of the, do you have a lot of customers on your list right now? Do you have customer relationships? Do you have vendor relationships and strategic partnerships like we talked about before?
Right.
You know, do you have the National Bar Association in your pocket? Is that that's a big deal. You know, if you have, you know, I want to open some hair salons. Yeah, we're not really interested. I've got a nationwide contract with Walmart to put one in front of every store. Okay, we're all of a sudden we're interested. You know, and we've got a locked contract. They won't let anybody else come in but us.
Okay.
See the difference in the deal?
Yeah, absolutely.
The major, major, major different thing. They're going to want to know the stage of the company. What stage is the company at development-wise? And we're going to talk about stages. It's the very next thing we're going to talk about.
Okay.
And they're going to, you know, the earlier the stage of the company, the less risk they're going to be willing to take. Because it's all about what have you proven.
So we're back to the proof again.
It's all back to the proof. What the stages of the company are based on what have you proven. I've proven that, A, you know, if you're bootstrapping, I've proven it works on paper. If you're in first round, I've proved it'll work in a focus group. Your first main round of financing with VC, I've proven it'll work in maybe a local market or a niche market. And then by the time you get the second round, you're trying to roll out to the national or global market in a big way. And you need a lot of funds to do that. So they're going to look at, do you have patents? Do you have trademarks? Do you have processes that are proprietary? Do you have pieces of software or technology that can't be easily duplicated?
That's just like kind of what real estate you already have, so to speak.
Exactly. You know, you're in the hotel business. Do you have some prime land already? Is that maybe that's your advantage, that I want to build hotels? Well, we're not really interested in hotels. Yeah, but we've got a prime piece of property on the Las Vegas Strip, and we've got one in downtown New York at Fifth Avenue. Well,
you're going to get some people interested.
It's a whole different animal. See what I mean?
It's like, oh, why didn't you say that sooner?
Yeah, right. You know, and you know, lastly, well, not lastly, they're going to also ask you, you know, stuff like how you price-wise and profit-wise compete with your, you know, how you compare to your competition. And then lastly, have you made any money yet? Have you grossed any money yet? Have you sold anything yet? You know, what have you sold? What activity level are you at?
It's like, so what truly is your level of seriousness, and, you know, like, are you yourself already putting money into this?
And in technology, now when you're into stuff like medical technology, a lot of that may come down to how far are you down the regulatory rabbit hole. Doesn't necessarily mean, you know, there are a lot of companies that raise money in the medical field based on how close they are to an FDA approval for something.
So how many of the hoops have you already jumped in?
They haven't made a cent yet. And in that field, it's really weird because it's how well have you managed your losses? You know, have you got to stage 3 of clinical trials and have only lost $100 million? You're doing a great job. It's such a different paradigm because they know if you get through that FDA approval, you may make billions, you know. So the upside is extremely high. They're willing to accept some front end
that's downside. Really interesting.
And if you're managing the downside well, they're probably going to be okay with that. I mean, in the online business, it's a lot of it's about customer acquisition. You may have, Google's valuation was insane before they ever put the first ad up. You know, they had a multi-$100 million+ valuation before they ever took in a cent in revenue. Because they had millions of eyeballs. They had millions of daily users. So it wasn't a matter of whether they would make money when they started monetizing that. It's just a matter of how much money they'd make.
Right.
And probably, I don't know this is what happened because nobody ever knows what happens at Google. But probably what they did was they probably said, okay, we're going to run ads today on 1 million searches and just see what happens. And that was probably over within 30 minutes. They said, okay, we ran ads on 1 million random searches today, and we made $50,000. That was really all they had to do.
Because they had the eyeballs.
Yeah, and we've got, you know, 300 million viewers a day. That was 1 million. We made $50,000. We got 300 million a day and growing like a rocket.
Right.
Do you think they had a hard time raising money?
No. Like, I mean, who wants to be a part of this?
Yeah, who wants to stand in line? They were probably, go get a number.
They were probably interviewing VCs.
Oh, yeah. There's no question they were interviewing VCs. They had an auction process to sell their stock at IPO.
Yeah.
So, yeah, people bid insane money to buy their stock. So that should show up. I'm glad I brought that up. That really proves a point. They only had to prove they only had to prove what they could do on a very small scale. But they showed, they proved their market size.
And the ability to scale up.
Yeah, they absolutely proved their market size first. Then they proved their ability to monetize. And that's really it. Everything else from there was upside. So that being said, that's kind of, I hope that gives kind of an idea of what valuation is. Now, you also have to know there's a difference between, there's a definite difference between post-money valuation and pre-money valuation.
Okay.
Your company is going to be worth a different amount of money after you're funded. Okay. So let's say, for instance, in post-money valuation is what really matters. You've determined that your company's worth $1 million based on some of the equations that we just laid out. It's worth $1 million. If a company comes in and decides to give you $500,000, they roughly should own 33% of the company. Now, that makes sense right away, does it?
No.
You think they don't have. The reason they don't own 33% because post-money, once they've given you $500,000 to put into the company,
okay,
it's equity at that point inside the company. It's working capital. So your company is now worth $1.5 million.
All right.
So if they want to invest $500,000, they're fundamentally buying one-third of the company.
That's interesting.
Kind of understand?
I do.
Works a little bit differently. So that's the post-money valuation. Now,
Now you had mentioned before, like the stage of your business, and how do you make sure, the stage that you're at, I guess how do you know what stage is in, and is that a big difference on how the valuation is set?
Yeah, it absolutely is. I mean, I'm gonna give you just a round number, okay, on each of these stages, and this is certainly not saying that this is what your deal is worth, what it's gonna bring. Any of that, but these are kind of averages that you see along multiple deals.
Okay.
Okay. So typically speaking, you got a couple stages. The first stage is the bootstrapping stage. We talked about that. That's
right.
Where you're actually putting together your business plan. You're traveling to see your competitors. You're researching, and you're really just putting together. Spending most of your time putting together a package, and really understanding your market, just getting yourself super, super duper educated, okay? And that amount of money is going to be minimal, probably what you can raise at your party.
Right.
So to speak. And, for a couple $1,000, you should be able to really put together a good package, really research a market very well, and really get your ducks in a row. That money is going to come out of your pocket, your family and friends, stuff like that. And the good news is, you typically don't have to give up any any percentage of ownership. And that's really nice.
That is nice.
you usually don't have to give any percentage of ownership for that. Maybe very minimal with your friends and family. But, and if you can work from there, kudos to you. So now you got all that done. The next thing you're probably going to want to do is go out and seek some seed money. This is the seed money stage. And this is basically, can still be rich relatives, rich friends. Maybe you go back to your group of 20 people and say, I've determined that the next round here, and usually I'd say an average on this round is going to be around $100,000,
$150,000.
Okay. Maybe a little less, $50,000 to $150,000. And you may go back and say, hey, I've decided to go out and start seeking funding. I'm going to need $100,000 to get through the first round of everything and basically get my first focus group proven. I want to do some focus groups. I want to develop prototype products. I want to get it out to the market. I want to get my products out to the market in a limited way, see what the response is, gather some data, and really get some rubber meets the road, real deal information.
Okay.
The smartest people you'll ever deal with is your consumer. They're going to tell you what they want.
Right.
So that's probably about, let's just say for sake of argument, it's $100,000. You're probably going to go to angel investors for that. And you're probably not going to have to give up a whole lot of percentage of your business. I mean, somewhere probably 25% of your business is pretty reasonable.
That's not too painful.
It's not too painful. Now, that's if you've proven quite a lot in your bootstrapping stage. If you've proven something in your bootstrapping stage that you've got this, especially if you have some proprietary technology or something like that, there's actually quite a lot of people out there with you know, angel groups and stuff that would share a deal like that, where two or three guys will throw in 30 grand a piece and just roll a dice on you, because it's not any money to them, although it's a lot of money to you.
Right.
You know, it's not a lot of money to them. So that's the, you know, the second stage. Now, the third stage, or the first stage, actually, and some people call it, is Series A round. This is your first, by the way, in the seed round, you're probably going to hire some people, maybe. You're going to really develop your marketing plan out. You're going to start marketing your product. Series A round is, typically speaking, where you're going to go to, you know, you're going to go to an angel fund. You may even go to a VC fund at this point. And you've got your complete marketing plan done, working, proven, with limited statistics. You've made some sales at this point. You've generated some cash. You have your corporation set up. You are a company. You're operating.
So basically, you're a business. You just need funds to grow.
Yeah, you're operating at this point. So yeah. You've opened one restaurant, and you've proven that, you know, barbecued eel is the new big trend in restaurants.
Right. Okay.
In this one marketplace, you took a 10% share of all restaurants with your new eel restaurant.
Right? Your eel burgers.
You're whipping up your eel burgers, right? So you've proven that you can take a percentage in a market or two or three. And if you can prove it in two or three markets, better yet. If you've got one in Austin, one in LA, and one in New York, and you can prove that all three are you're pulling roughly the same market share, then you're able to go back and say, this is what I got. I got three restaurants. You know, each one of them costs $100,000 to open. Each one of them costs $20,000 to open. We've made back our $20,000 in 3 months, and we're steadily holding a 10% market share. Then you've got something to go show. Now I'd like to open in this round of financing. I'd like to bring in equity investors for another $350,000. We want to open 20 more units, and that's what we're going to do with the money. So it's total expansion money. Remember, they're going to want to give you money to expand only.
Right.
Burn that into your brain.
Okay.
You're in debt. You've borrowed a bunch of money. I really need to pay off my credit cards. Can you invest some money? Screw you. No way. They only want to invest money that's going to multiply. If you go pay your credit card off, there's no multiples that comes from that.
Right.
Other than the multiples of the hours that you get to sleep at night.
Okay.
It doesn't have anything to do with their money. So basically, in that round, you know, you can probably still hold on to control, you know, in most cases. If you've got a good, solid plan, let's say you're raising $300,000 or $400,000, and you may give up 48%, 45%. I try not to give away control at that point, because you're gonna get around that. Don't worry.
Right.
And then lastly is your second round, your round two financing, or some people call this Series B round. And this is basically where you've proven now you got 20 locations in your eel restaurant, right? And it's all still running steady. But you know, you're not really a manager, you're an entrepreneur, and some things are slipping through the cracks, and you know, everything's going good, but you go back and say, look, here's the deal. I've proven this concept. I got, you know, my eels on wheels food carts are kicking butt all across America. But I don't really know how to run a great big multinational company. So here's what I'd like to do. I'd like to raise $3 million. I'd like to hire a good executive staff. I'd like to go out and open 100 more restaurants and just really blow it up. And in 3 years, I'd like to sell out to Wolfgang Puck, because he's going to realize the growth potential in eel is insane.
Eel's the real deal.
Eel's the real deal. There you go. We wrote a tagline right there. So he's going to realize pretty soon that eel's the big deal. And so let's go ahead and get us a big team. Let's get us a bunch of restaurants open. Let's start being a pain in the neck and cutting into market share of other guys, and to the point where a Red Lobster or some, you know, Fridays or some big restaurant chain is going to come in and acquire us.
Got it.
Okay.
Yeah.
So we want to borrow $3 million to do that. At that point, you are almost surely going to give up control. That's just part of it.
And do you think that'll actually, and you've mentioned this previously, but like actually maybe even doing that, coming into it, letting them know, like, I plan to give up control, like you'll...
It's not a bad thing. There are some things to be considered when you give up control that kind of suck. I mean, typically speaking, the people you're getting funding from have a lot more money than you do, and they can stand not to draw money out of the company. And they're going to try to leave as much money in the company to make it as attractive as they can for a big ticket sale in the end.
Okay? Right.
The downer is for you that if they decide not to take out money and they're in control of the company, then there won't be any disbursements.
So you don't get to take out any money.
Yeah. So the best thing that you can do is negotiate yourself a really good employment contract at the beginning of each of these deals. So you say, hey, look, I'll still sit as a chairman of the board. I don't care how soon we sell the company. I'd like for it to sell for the maximum amount, just like you. But I need to get a $100,000 or $200,000 a year salary while we wait. You know?
Right.
And that way, that makes them feel good that you're not going to be banging on the door every day going, man, I really need cash, really need cash, really need cash. Because the last thing they want to do is strip the company of cash.
Right.
Because they're going to try to take that cash to fuel growth. Because they know the faster they can grow, the more they can get out there in the marketplace, the bigger target is placed on their head.
Right, absolutely.
And once your company gets to the point it's doing, there are different levels. Companies over about $10 million get attractive to mergers and acquisitions companies. And these are companies that basically put together groups of companies and then sell them to publicly traded companies most of the time. The publicly traded company won't typically buy a $10 million company. They'll buy a $100 million company, which may be a grouping of 10 $10 million companies. Does that make sense?
It does. I mean, what is it about the $10 million versus the $100 million that
they don't want?
Yeah.
The cost to acquire is very expensive because the publicly traded companies have to pay for incredible due diligence. And they have to integrate all the accounting. They have to integrate all the management. It's a pain in the neck. It probably costs, to buy a $100 million company, it probably cost them somewhere between $3 to $5 million just to buy you.
Wow.
So it probably doesn't cost a whole lot less than that for them to buy a $10 million company.
I see.
See what I mean?
Yeah, that makes sense.
And what these guys do that are mergers and acquisition companies, which is a really interesting business to be in, what they do is basically they go around, they know exactly what it's going to take to make life easy on the publicly traded company, the guy that heads their acquisition department. So they're going to take your company, they're going to buy it, they're going to pull it into their fold. They're going to put it into the right accounting software. They're going to get the right management people on board. They're going to get the right financial people on board. They're going to get all the reporting and SEC documents already. They're going to have everything. It's going to be packaged up in a nice, big, pretty box with a bow on top.
Got it.
So that when that publicly traded company says, what do you got? And they're looking. I mean, they're looking. There's a lot more money. Again, I'll say it again. Even at that level, especially at that level, there's a whole lot more money out there than there are deals.
Right.
And when you, I'm going to try to explain a principle here that's kind of hard to get across to a lot of people, but imagine this. Most publicly traded companies are trading at somewhere between 20 and 40 times earnings. Okay. Some as many as 100 times earnings.
Okay.
High-tech companies. Okay?
All right.
So what that means is, let's just say on the low side that a publicly traded company is selling at 20, is worth, their share price is 20 times earnings. Okay?
All right.
If they acquire a company at 10 times its earnings, the instant they acquire it, it's worth twice as much.
What they already paid.
So if they buy, it's a way for them to grow. In other words, if their stock collectively is worth $100 million, let's just say, and you've got a company that's earning $10 million a year, right? If they got your company, it would be worth $200 million to them. So all of a sudden, instead of their stock being worth $10 a share, it's worth $30 a share. Okay.
So it's just, it instantly increases their value.
It instantly increases their value by a multiple of somewhere between 20 and 50, depending on what they're trading at. So they have a guy that sits in an office or a lady that sits in an office all day and looks for companies that they can acquire for less than 20 times earnings that fit their market plan, that have a synergy with them. And usually they're going to buy a company that maybe they're a distributor of, like Whole Foods is here in Austin.
Right.
They probably target buying vitamin companies and organic farms and things like that. Because not only can they buy them, get a big flip on the multiple, but then they can distribute their products through their distribution chain. There's a synergy there that works. You know, Blockbuster Video bought Paramount because Blockbuster could distribute Paramount films.
Right, that makes sense.
So it was a Viacom, actually. It was a Viacom deal. Okay. But that's the kind of deals. Those are the best deals. That's not always the deals that get done. There are some companies out there that are just literally big cash vacuums.
And they're looking to spend it.
That acquire practically anything. That is pretty. So what happens is, let's say your company is, like we said earlier in our example, making $2 million a year. So this is the way everything kicks up the channel. So your company's going to make $2 million a year. Let's say you've advanced 2 years, and sure enough, you're making $2 million a year.
Okay.
An M&A company may come in and pay you 5x earnings, even though your books are kind of weird and your team is kind of weak. And by this time, they know as an entrepreneur, you're probably freaking out.
Right.
Because you're in over your head, right? And you'd really just like to cash out. And when they hold out $10 million in cash, you go, ooh, $10 million.
Here it is.
Shake it in front of your face. It's more money than you've ever possibly seen. And you're going to go, take it.
Right.
So they just bought you for 5x value for $10 million, right? They can probably go in, bring in these teams of just troubleshooters, basically. And the short-term CEOs, short-term CFOs. And they're going to swoop into your company and in 6 months fix everything that's wrong. Package it, dress it out, make it all perfect. And in 6 months' time, they're going to go to a publicly traded company and say, I got this gem over here that I can let go for only 12x earnings.
So they instantly, flip it.
They instantly flip it. In 6 months, they made $5 million. You made $5 million. You made $10 million to start with. They just made $10 million in 6 months for just knowing where to go to sell, how to package it, right, to sell. So as soon as it's done, it's not a question of whether they can sell it or not. It's a certainty. These M&A companies are being bombarded by publicly traded companies, their acquisition teams going, man, what do you got? What do you got? What do you got? I got to feed the pipe. Because there's constant pressure for incredible growth out of publicly traded companies right now. And in most companies, only about half of growth comes from sales and activity. The other half comes from acquisition. So when you understand that whole concept of how the cycle works, I know this is kind of really premature for most people that are listening right now, but it's a good idea to understand how the whole system works.
Well, it helps you really see the end picture and see what other people are looking to gain.
Yeah, and realize this too, when you're buying stock on the stock market, you're paying absolute retail. So basically, you're paying absolute retail for the value of the company.
So M&A is in the wholesale business.
They're in the wholesale business. There's wholesale and sub-wholesale. I mean, you're basically the publicly traded company that has an acquisitions department is in the wholesale business. I mean, he's buying watermelons for $5 and selling them to you for $10. Okay?
Got it.
There's a guy in between that's buying them from the grower at $2. That's the founder, and selling them to the M&A, selling them to the publicly traded company for $5, you know. So everybody in between is stepping on somewhere and making money.
Got it.
And now a lot of times these deals, you can maintain positions and seats and move up. If you're an integral part to the operation, you may want to do that. And sometimes people will sell based on gaining experience or based on getting themselves into the door of a publicly traded company. Because if you're needed enough, if they like you enough and you're doing a good job, you may get a long-term employment contract, a seat on the board. You can get all kinds of things.
So, I mean, it'd be a good idea to have a plan for kind of seeing yourself a part of the picture, like if you want to be, like kind of.
Yeah, and a lot of times they're going to really want to know that. I mean, if you've just done a dynamic job, I mean, I had a company one time that I had really just put my heart and soul into it. And I couldn't hardly sell it because I kind of moved on to other things. And I had a lot of people that looked at it and said, you know, if you're not going to stay, we're not interested in buying because you kind of are the company.
You're kind of a major piece.
So try to, you know, while you want to be a dynamic figure in leading your company, you definitely want to start very soon in getting people trained, getting people knowing what they're doing so that you want to prove to them. You know, I took a month off and went to Hawaii last year. And actually, we had a sales increase while I was gone. I think when I got out of the way, everything ran better.
Right.
That's a big deal for an M&A company or for a publicly traded company because they know then it's the system that's working, not the person.
Which is way more interesting to them.
Yeah, they'd much rather buy a working system. I always say McDonald's. Does McDonald's make the best hamburger in the world?
No.
But they have the best system in the world at selling hamburgers.
And a system is where you can just pump more money into it and the system just cranks. The system's
worth billions. Yeah. You know, you can make a better hamburger and sit up next to them all day, they're going to beat your brains out. It's because they've got a better system. So
makes sense.
That's pretty much, you know, I hope you understood valuation. I know it sounds kind of vague, but and you're going to have to, there's a lot of fluff that goes into valuation. I would always give people advice, aim on the high side. Don't be ridiculous, but aim on the high side. There's a... I love this quote. I was at a guy Kawasaki, he's a great entrepreneur, and responsible for tons and tons of startups. So I was at a conference with him not too long ago, and there was a speaker there, and the speaker said, you know, he was a VC for one of the largest VC firms in the country, and he says, you know what? When you come in and do these 2 years, 3 year, 5 year projections, and you're all sitting at home at night trying to figure out what you're going to put on a piece of paper. And you go, man, this is just bullshit. I'm having to come up with this is bullshit. He said, you know what? We know it's bullshit. We just want to know the magnitude of your bullshit. How much do you really believe is over the top possible? Don't make it insane where it can't be, but in the best case scenario, if everything goes perfectly well, how much money are you going to make and base your valuation on that?
Why is that? What are they looking for?
They're looking for people who aim very high. You know, they're looking for people who aim very high. Okay. You know, when Kennedy said, we're going to go to the moon, everybody thought he was from the moon. I mean, nobody could go to the moon. Come on. And in less than 10 years, we're on the moon. So it's when you set those... they realize that people who set goals that seem unreachable... but have passion and believe in them, can usually accomplish them.
Or get close.
But it takes part of your soul with it a lot of times. You know? And they don't want to give that up. They're great. They'd love to fund you and let you work 90 hours a week to accomplish those things.
Let you get the arrows in your back?
Yeah, let you get the arrows in your back. So if they can let you take the arrows and they get some ching in their pocket at the end, everybody's happy. And they'll let you facilitate the dream, as they say. So... But that's basically it on valuations.
Okay.